Insightful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Yemeni Armed Forces spokesman says the Saudi King Khalid base and Najran airport have been hit by drones and ballistic missiles in retaliatory attacks. And the incumbent chief minister's party in West Bengal defeats India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi's party in a state election. Welcome. Our top story, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has hailed the valuable role played by the country's Quds Force, that is the overseas branch of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Ayatollah Khamenei said the West seeks to keep Iran's foreign policy under its own influence and domination as in the pre-Islamic Revolution era. That is why, the leader added, the West is outraged and aggrieved every time Iran seeks to establish ties with Russia and China. He said the Americans have on numerous occasions prevented visits to Iran by senior officials from its Arab neighbors. Ayatollah Khamenei also spoke about sanctions against Iran. He said the best and most successful way to nullify them is a genuine effort to boost national production. The leader also touched upon the upcoming presidential election, saying the vote is an important opportunity for Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei stressed that elections have always been clean in Iran. Mostafa Khoshchashm is a journalist and political analyst. He says the U.S. has been attempting to cut Iran's ties with the world through smear campaigns, but it has failed to achieve its objective.
It's highly important to note that Americans know pretty well that if they intend to maximize the effectiveness of their sanctions, they needed to contain Iran's economic power, especially in ties with the outside world, with the Russians as well as the Chinese, and also the original states. But more important than that is that they always try to contain Iran's power, overall power. We're talking about various power components, not just the military or the nuclear industries, but Iran's scientific advancements and Iran's soft power, especially in the region. In the words of a former top Pentagon official who said that we do not want to let Iran become a role model for the regional nations. It's understood why, when it comes to the regional nations and Iran's soft power in there, the Americans have been trying to alienate Iran, demonize Iran, running smear campaign about Iran's intentions. And that's why they've been doing their best to contain Iran's relations with the outside world, and they have failed, of course.
The U.S. president has reportedly said Washington is not close to returning to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. According to a senior Israeli official, Joe Biden made the comment in a meeting with the head of the Israeli regime's intelligence service, Mossad, during a visit to Washington on Friday by an Israeli delegation. Biden reportedly said the U.S. has a long way to go in talks with Iran before it agrees to return to full compliance. A spokesperson for the U.S. National Security Council, however, said Mossad Chief Yossi Cohen's meeting at the White House was with advisor Jake Sullivan and other national security officials, not with Biden. The developments come as Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal are holding talks in Vienna to revive the accord. The Yemeni army says it has conducted fresh strikes on targets inside Saudi Arabia. Yemeni army spokesman Yahya Seri said the army successfully targeted King Khalid Air Base in Khamis Mushayt and Najran Airport. The attacks were carried out using four Qasif K2 drones and two ballistic missiles. The spokesman said the attacks were in response to Saudi Arabia's escalation of aggression and continued siege of Yemen. However, Riyadh said its air defenses intercepted an explosive-laden drone. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Yemeni fighters have stepped up their retaliatory attacks against the kingdom in recent months. Let's check out the latest on that story through our man Abdul Latif Al-Washali, who joins us via satellite out of the Yemeni capital of Sana'a. Abdulatif, if you hear me, welcome to the program. Fill us in on the latest information coming out from that attack.
Thank you so much. A new retaliatory attack has been carried out by the Yemeni army for a class of K2 drones and two ballistic missiles of Badr type attack King Khalid Air Base in Asir and also other military targets in Najran Airport. This operation comes in retaliation for the ongoing Saudi war and siege against the Yemeni people. The Yemeni army also intensified its operations on the ground. Saudi Crown Prince said earlier that the kingdom is striving for peace in Yemen and to stop the ongoing war on the Yemeni people. But on the ground, we see tighter restrictions on fuel imports, and Yemenis are still suffering from the severe siege imposed on them. We are on the latest 10 days of Ramadan, and Yemenis are still suffering from this devastating war, unfortunately.
Okay. You know, one question that comes to mind, Abdul Latif, in all honesty, is that we've had reports of the attacks of this kind on that particular location inside Saudi Arabia. I'm talking about that airport. You know, and with these drones targeting and bombing it almost every day or once in every 2 days, I would imagine that that airport must have been totally destroyed so far. Do you have any information, or do you get any information or data on that, how badly the airport is damaged at this point? Is there any need to bomb it again, or how long do you think the Yemeni forces are going to bomb it, continue bombing it to make it non-operational and perhaps, you know, target somewhere else?
According to the Yemeni army, to the spokesman of the Yemeni army, all the operations launched against the Saudi airports are accurate. They have accurate information that these airports are being used to for military purposes against the Yemeni people. The Saudi aircrafts are being launched from these airports, so the Yemeni army will continue targeting these airports to stop Saudi Arabia from using these civilian facilities for military purposes. The Yemeni army is not looking for targeting civilian facilities, but as long as these facilities are being used in the war against the Yemeni people, they will remain a legitimate target for the Yemeni army, and the Yemeni army will continue bombing the airports, will continue harming the Saudi economy by hitting Aramco facilities. The war should stop, and the Yemeni army, of course, will stop its operations and attacks deep inside the kingdom.
So are you suggesting, Abdul Latif, that the airport that has been targeted tonight as well is still operational, from which attacks are conducted against Yemen, despite this many attacks that Yemen has actually conducted on that airport? Is that what you're suggesting?
The airport may be still operational, but at the moment it will not be available for launching new attacks against the Yemeni people. It will be stopped for a specific period of time. The Yemeni army, as I've told you before, is not trying to destroy the whole airport as the Saudis have done to the Yemeni people.
I know,
they have destroyed the airports of the Yemeni people, the seaports, and the Yemeni army is trying to stop Saudis from using this civilian facility for their military purposes and launching their air jets that bombs the Yemeni people.
Now, that's the point. Many thanks. That's Abdul Latif Al-Washali in Sana'a, who joined us via satellite. I really appreciate it that you joined us at this early time. Abdul Latif, have a good day. Top Afghan military officials have confirmed the official start of the withdrawal of foreign troops from Afghanistan just after the departure of the first group of U.S. military forces from the country. The move has received mixed reactions in Afghanistan.
U.S.-led NATO forces are spending their last months in Afghanistan, and this is good news for most American soldiers. They will finally witness the end of their mission in a country historically known as the Graveyard of Empires. This is why the U.S. war in Afghanistan has so far claimed the lives of 90,000 U.S.-led NATO troops and Afghan armed forces. However, military top brass in Kabul insists that there is zero chance of victory for the Taliban through militarism, despite a start of foreign troops withdrawal from Afghanistan on Saturday. This is because the Afghan government is now strong enough to counter terrorist groups on its own and also enjoys high popularity among locals.
The withdrawal of foreign forces has practically started. They will hand over their military bases and some of their military hardware to Afghan forces by the end of this week. We are strong enough and we can safeguard the nation on our own.
In the meantime, the Taliban have not welcomed the troop pullout by Washington, saying the U.S. had agreed to withdraw all foreign military forces from Afghanistan by the May 1st. This has paved the way for the Taliban to legitimize their acts of violence beyond May the 1st. Under such circumstances, civilians will once again turn into the main victims of violence in the war-weary country.
Foreign troops must leave our country, and the Taliban are also expected to respect people's demand, that is the silence of guns. There must be no war among ourselves after the withdrawal of foreign troops, and the Taliban need to realize this reality.
The Taliban are seeking excuses to keep saying no to peace. The postponement of the U.S. military withdrawal has now turned into a good pretext for them to wage more war and kill more defenseless civilians.
The Taliban have vowed to take any possible action because of what they call the violation of the Doha Agreement by Washington, that is the delay in the withdrawal of foreign troops from Afghanistan. However, what remains to be a bitter truth is that not many players seem to be ready to truly help Afghans see a day when there is no war and insecurity in their wounded homeland. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu Nationalist Party has suffered a setback as it lost a fiercely contested state poll. Over the past month, some 175 million eligible voters cast ballots in five regional elections. The most important one was in the eastern state of West Bengal, home to 90 million people. Results showed Modi suffered a setback after his loss to the Trinamool Congress Party, known as the TMC, which is led by Mamata Banerjee. Thousands of TMC supporters also took to the streets despite a ban on celebrations due to COVID-19 pandemic. In a victory speech, Banerjee said her priority would be to combat the coronavirus. India has recorded its deadliest day of the coronavirus pandemic with nearly 3,700 fatalities in 24 hours alone. Sunday marks the fourth straight day that India registered more than 3,000 daily cases, or daily deaths, I should say. The Asian nation also reported over 392,000 new infections in the last 24 hours. Daily cases there have remained above 300,000 since April 22nd. India's total COVID deaths are over 215,000 out of 19.5 million cases. The virus surge is blamed on the government as it allowed millions of largely unmasked people to attend religious festivals and crowded political rallies in five states through March and April. Hospitals in India are currently overwhelmed. A shortage of medical oxygen is the most serious challenge there. A correspondent in New Delhi, Munawar Zaman, says the shortage of coronavirus vaccines has turned into a new challenge for India's crisis-hit healthcare system.
Well, besides having the oxygen supplies, which is still a great concern, which is the biggest concern the healthcare system is struggling with, there is now a biggest trouble with vaccine shortage. Vaccine is something which is not easily available to states. States are struggling with the vaccination supplies. And if you know the India's biggest vaccine supplier, the Serum Institute, its owner, Adar Poonawalla, has to leave the country. He has to leave India because he was getting threat calls from the elite class people or maybe some other groups. He had to leave the country to start production outside India.
Remaining with the issue of COVID-19, Brazilian officials report nearly 29,000 new confirmed COVID-19 cases, bringing the country's total closer to 15 million. Brazilian health authorities also registered over 1,200 new fatalities, pushing the toll to over 407,000. The country remains the world's second worst hit by the pandemic in terms of fatalities, Elsewhere in Latin America, Mexico reported over 1,000 new confirmed coronavirus cases and dozens of more deaths. The country's total number of cases now nears 2,350,000, with more than 217,000 fatalities. Bruno Biclini, a political scientist and professor of international studies, joins us via Skype out of Porto Alegre. Professor Biclini, it's good to have you with us. I'm just going to start with reasons perhaps why Brazil is experiencing such a situation. I know that in the past, President Bolsonaro has been largely criticized for his handling of the coronavirus, but I'm pretty sure, Professor, you also agree with me that it's not only one man's job to keep a country safe. It takes a lot of factors, including the cooperation of the people themselves. The fact that we are witnessing such a dire situation in Brazil with no let up in the situation, as far as I can remember, at least in the past few months, what do you say is the culprit?
I would say that it's not only what Bolsonaro did last year and his social base in the new Pentecostals so-called preachers do every day. For example, yesterday, May 1st, the Workers' Day, they put rallies all over the country in a proto-fascist demand, with proto-fascist speeches, and they also deny science. They refuse themselves, the majority of them, to use masks. I can give another example. There was a tape of one minister, a four-star general, telling his colleague that he wants to be vaccinated, without letting know the President Bolsonaro. President Bolsonaro refused himself to be vaccinated. I would say that 25% of our people, they are refusing science and denying the pandemic. That's the point.
All right. Many thanks. That's Professor Bruno Biclini. He's a professor of international studies as well as a political scientist, sharing his views with us about the COVID-19 situation in Brazil. Thank you, Professor. That's it for me.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. The bodies came one after another. So many bodies, in fact, that the ambulances and trucks carrying them into the crematorium blocked traffic. In New Delhi, India, a city where someone dies from COVID-19 every 4 minutes, every day is a battle not just for hospital beds, but for a space to say goodbye to the dead with dignity. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian columnist Hannah Ellis Peterson. The piece is titled Grief and Anger as COVID Victims Overwhelm Delhi's Crematoriums. Bodies came one after another. So many bodies, in fact, that the ambulances and trucks carrying them into the crematorium blocked traffic. In New Delhi, India's capital, a city where someone dies from COVID-19 every 4 minutes, every day is a battle not just for hospital beds, but for a space to say goodbye to the dead with dignity. The official capacity at the Ghazipur crematorium in East Delhi is 38 bodies. And before the pandemic, Only once in living memory had all the funeral pyres been taken in one day. Now, as a deadly second coronavirus wave sweeps the Indian capital, sometimes 150 bodies have already arrived by early morning. The staff of it have expanded operations into the car park, but it's not nearly enough. In India's capital, the coronavirus is showing no sign of abating. On Friday morning, 30th of April, Delhi registered another record-breaking 395 deaths and 24,235 cases. Across India, the total number of confirmed new cases of coronavirus was 386,693, another global record. Crematoriums are expanding at a rapid pace in India, attempting to increase capacity to cope with 1,000 cremations a day. It is here, among the pyres that get rebuilt every day for the Hindu and Sikh last rites, that the devastation caused by the COVID-19 in India's capital is most viscerally felt. Most lost their lives because families could not get them to a hospital bed, could not get them oxygen. Some got to hospitals only for the hospital to run out of oxygen. Sitting on the floor, wearing personal protective equipment in the sweltering Delhi heat, sobbing into his hands and wiping sweat from his brow, Rakesh Kumar, a 36-year-old, described how his family had driven to every hospital in New Delhi and in the neighboring city of Noida, when his mother, Sumitra Devi, had begun to struggle for breath as her oxygen crashed. But the 56-year-old never got a bed, and she died last Thursday morning. We tried so many hospitals, but even when her oxygen went down to 40%, we could not get her a hospital bed, said Rakesh Kumar. We kept going to hospitals where we were told there was availability of beds, but every time the hospital said they were full. If we could have got her a bed in hospital or got her oxygen in time, we could have saved her life. But she didn't even get a chance to survive. Like many laying their dead to rest, he was angry. The government has failed its citizens. Why could it not give us the health care that we need? Said Rakesh Kumar. In his 30 years helping to cremate the dead, Sunil Kumar Sharma, who is the head of Ghazipur Crematorium, said he had never imagined such scenes. So many dead, he said. It feels like if this continues, there will be no one left in Delhi. Though there is supposed to be strict protocol on handling the dead bodies of coronavirus victims, Sunil Kumar Sharma said hospitals often sent corpses over without any protective wrapping, risking exposing his staff to the virus. Some families, he said, tried to hide that their relatives had died of COVID-19. Narendra Kumar, a 26-year-old ambulance driver who picks up COVID bodies every day from homes and hospitals to bring to the crematoriums, also confirmed that most people he was seeing had died from lack of oxygen. "This is a terrible job," said Narendra Kumar. "I'm so scared of infecting my family that I don't go home anymore. At the end of the day, I just park my ambulance outside Gangaram Hospital and sleep there." Krishnan Pal, a 48-year-old who sold the popular Indian snack Pani Puri in his Delhi stall, was among those who died after repeatedly being turned away from overloaded hospitals when he was struggling to breathe. His cousin, Kali Charan Kashyap, said they had tried every hospital in New Delhi but could not get a hospital bed, so they drove him to Agra, a city in the neighboring state of Uttar Pradesh. In Agra, they were told that there were hospital beds but that hospitals had no oxygen. As they were driving to Bareilly, another city in Uttar Pradesh province, Pal died. People are literally dying on the roads because they can't breathe, said Kashyap, though choking sobs as the family waited for Krishnan Pal's body to arrive from the morgue. India needs oxygen, so I ask this government, where is it? The political implications of a second coronavirus wave on Narendra Modi's government are becoming apparent. According to the Global Leader Approval Tracker, Narendra Modi has suffered an unprecedented 6 percentage point drop in his popularity in the past week, with his approval rating at its lowest ever level, though still high at 67%, and his disapproval rating going up to 28%. Many believe vaccines are the only long-term way out of India's coronavirus crisis, but New Delhi citizens were dealt a blow this week when the local government said plans to open up vaccinations to anyone aged 18 years and over from Saturday were being delayed indefinitely because of a lack of supplies of vaccines. Similar shortages are being experienced across India. Though the New Delhi State Chief Minister, Arvind Kejriwal, said authorities would make vaccines available as soon as possible, several private clinics and private hospitals in New Delhi said they were not expecting stocks for at least another month or even 2 months. So for now, New Delhi's crematoriums and graveyards will continue to bear the burden of death that shrouds the city every day. At Ghazipur Crematorium, as the sun sets and all the pyres were finally assembled, they were set alight at the same time, going up in a fiery roar of heat and pain. Food for thought. Hello, dear friends, and our condolences to all on the fateful 19th of Ramadan, the day on which, whilst engrossed in the morning prayer in the Grand Mosque of Kufa in Iraq, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, was struck a fatal blow of a poisoned sword by the renegade, Abdul Rahman ibn Muljam. And the expression that came to the lips of the mortally injured vicegerent of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as his fruitful 63-year life was about to end, was, "By the Lord of Kaaba, I have succeeded."
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the problems and questions that parents have in regards to the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are mostly based on the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And to help us with our questions, we have in the studio with us our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza al-Miyakko. It's always nice to have you here, Brother Miqdad. Thank you very much for being with us.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. The pleasure is all mine.
So the question today is, I recently saw an advertisement to teach programming to 10-year-old children. Would you recommend that? So I guess it could be too soon for them. It might hurt their eyes. So would you recommend that 10-year-olds learn programming?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, you could find reasons why this should not be. Perhaps this parents finds it concerning. Perhaps it could be as a matter of priority. I mean, there's so much out there you could do with a 10-year-old, right? From Quran classes to different activities related to sports and exercise, socializing, why programming, right? Perhaps that could be the perspective from which the question is asked. I would say programming is a good thing, for sure. Especially, it depends on how it's approached. But programming in itself, parents who are not familiar with this, so just quickly, a quick background. Programming is when you're coding the kind of software, or you're coding a program for it to be doing a particular thing, basically, right? It comes in different languages. You can make it web, you can make it app, you can make it desktop software. It's got different perspective and different languages to it, etc. But there are concepts and there are principles behind all of them that are very interesting. And I would kind of recommend parents to think about it, because it's not a bad thing, for sure. There's certain a very interesting point that comes out from it. For example, two of the things that really would be beneficial for a child is problem solving and logic. Problem solving and logic are things that you learn whilst you're learning programming. They're actually fundamental to any programming, because you need to have a problem, basically, okay? And you need to then find a logical solution to this problem and put this into a kind of a code, something to be able to answer that problem. And I find that very, very useful for children, even at the age of 10, even younger than 10, children who know how to read and children who know how to use the computer at a very basic level. If you start teaching them programming, but with this angle that they're actually learning how to problem solve, right, and basic languages that they're going to learn, whether it's to do with CSS and HTML, for example, on a web base, where they're actually training how to put a few sentences on one side and actually see results straight away on the other, right? You put, for example, red square box, and you see a red square box appear on the other side. Or it's app-related, where you're actually kind of designing a kind of a program to do something for you, whether it's coming up with, I don't know, a random recipe, for example, to solve the problem that I don't know what to cook tonight.
So programming can be good for creativity, for problem solving, but most of all logic, because programming is basically at the root of it, logic.
Yes.
Let's take a break, and we'll be back for more advice from Brother Maghdad. Don't go away.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we're talking about whether it's okay to teach 10-year-olds programming. So you said there's nothing particularly wrong about it, but some parents might think that there are more important things to learn than programming. Just before the break, we said that programming can be good for creativity, for problem solving, and for logic.
One of the things that happens with children is that they're busy with a lot of theory parts, especially when you go to school. Nowadays, a lot of schools are like that. You're very busy with theoretical parts of things, right? You know a lot and you have a lot of information, but some things like logic and problem solving are rarely taught in school, right? And kind of programming would actually help them in that sphere, is to really be able to give them a real problem, right? Say, for example, at home, I don't know, mom doesn't know what to cook. Every single day, mom wakes up in the morning, I don't know what to cook today, right? What's going to be in the menu? And it's quite confusing. That's what a problem we have. Is it possible for me to come up with a system, okay, a program, for example, where I'm going to give 25 recipes on one side, okay, or 25 options on one side, and then randomly it'll give me a menu at the beginning of the week, okay, which will really solve the problem. It's a very silly problem, but here's a child who actually now will have to go and find, he's got a problem in his mind, okay, and he wants to solve a problem. He'll have to do a research about the different types of food that there are, be able to code a system by which you can choose amongst his food for the week what to cook, what the menu of the week, basically. The point being is that you've actually put a child into a real-life situation where in a real-life problem is in front of him, and here's a child who logically will come up with a solution using a very important tool, a very modern and important tool, which is the computer, and through programming be able to design a solution for it. I find that a very important skill, and perhaps would be priority over other things as well. Obviously, not taking the place of other things, but I wouldn't neglect this very important or very interesting thing. Obviously, with the how it's done and how it's conducted is also very important.
Okay, and might there be any inconsistency between learning programming and our Islamic teachings or our Islamic identity?
I don't see any. Obviously, there's a lot of prerequisites that parents have to be careful, right? When you have a child in front of the computer, they make sure that it's not in the room or locked by himself. The internet is under control. The child is not being distracted by doing other things. You've chosen sites and softwares that are safe, that are not going to have any advertisement. The child knows that he can't venture into YouTube and do all sorts of other things. It's in a controlled environment. You've done all your prerequisites to ensure that this doesn't come into an influence that's going to be negative. Other than that, no, there's no particular reason why this would contradict any principle that we discuss in Tarbiyah.
What if a father wishes that their child to be, for instance, a cleric, and a Muslim cleric, and suddenly feels that what if he goes to programming and likes it so much that he'll, not just a cleric actually, a medic or whatever, and then what if my child goes to programming and likes it so much that they'll put that idea behind altogether?
We have to understand that programming is a tool, right? And you can use this tool for anything. A Muslim cleric can use this tool to make softwares that are religiously based, for example. A doctor can use this tool to make a software for all his patients. Basically, it's a tool that can be used in any sphere of our life.
It can also be a career.
It's true. But when you approach and you teach programming, you're teaching the child that this is a tool, okay? And this is what you want to use to actually solve problems, whatever the problem is. And then it's up to the parent to give those kind of problems to the child that they actually feel are important. Now if the parent, for example, wants to kind of direct the child to be a doctor, for example, then you can give the child kind of problems that are medical related. Although at a 10-year-old, kind of difficult to assume that. But the key is, you see, is that the problems that the child is facing is now going to be solved, or you're trying to teach him how to solve this problem using a tool called programming.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break. We'll be back after the break for more discussions on this topic.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about programming, teaching 10-year-old children to use programming as a tool, and concerns that parents may have. Another concern that some parents may have is that their children become computer-wise much smarter than them, and they will lose their control over the kind of content that their children sees or what they're up to on the computer, because we know that especially the internet can be especially dangerous to children for what it exposes them to, that they would become too smart for them to control.
This is a fear that can be generalized to a lot of different things as well. When parents are teaching, or any teacher when he's teaching, there's always this fear that my child or my student will be able to know more than I do. I would like to say that this is actually not a fear. It should actually be a pride. A good teacher and a good parent always wants their child to be greater than them, right? Because you want progress to happen. When you want to teach somebody something, you want him to know so much that at one point he'll be able to teach it himself, or be able to even teach you, right?
But the concern is that the parent will lose the leverage to control the children from getting into stuff they shouldn't get into.
That's correct. That's an important concern. Parents need to then step up the game as well and be able to be on top of it as well. And perhaps they should go on a course as well. They should work with the child in a way that they too are learning, if the child is learning, and they understand how things work. You don't have to learn the intricacies and the details of it, obviously. I'm not encouraging parents to start learning Java and PHP and all these different languages that are in programming. But at least if they have an idea what programming means, if they know what it involves and what are the different things that are that encompasses it, then they can know what the child is doing. Basically, they have an idea of what the child is doing without knowing all the different particularities regarding this.
Let's extrapolate this question to other things that we can teach children. For instance, graphic modeling, art, basically. Can that be dangerous for children to learn at 10 years of age?
So media arts is another world altogether. It's not programming anymore. It's to do with Photoshop and animations and After Effects and those kind of things. Again, it's a very good thing to get involved in, for sure, especially children that are very creative, children that have the kind of touch for arts. It's actually very attractive as well, because you can draw something and make it come alive, basically. It's very children very appreciate this kind of thing. And I would definitely encourage parents who have children who are interested in these things to get them to courses that involve media and artworks, for sure. But again, it's not difficult to learn, but it's a long process to learn it and to acquire the different skills that are related to it, but definitely worth starting into it. Again, it's a tool. You can use it for different things. You can use these After Effects and animation to portray on clip on how to be eating better and how to take care of your teeth, for example. Or you can use it for religious purposes, you can use it for cooking and recipes, you can use it for different things. Again, it's a tool that you want to teach a child that you can have a problem, for example, you want to pass on a message, you want to market a particular product, you want to kind of entertain someone, and here's a tool that you can use, whether it's animation or After Effects or whatever it is, and you want to teach them how to use this tool. Again, be very careful when you do use this, that Google should not be a free way to use it. They can't just go to any images and free web, basically. It should be under control. It should be under supervision of their parents. It should be in a controlled environment that they that you know what they're doing. Again, like any other tools, it can be misused as
well. Is it okay for parents to install spyware on their computers to watch over what their children are doing? And if you could give a very short response to that.
I would give priority to blockers than spying, basically. You rather block things rather than spy on what the child does and later on find out that they did this, right? More important than that is to just block those things that are, you know, that are not necessary for the child to go into.
Okay, thank you very much. That's all the time that we have, although there's so much to talk about. If you missed our program, don't worry. You can always download an archive of this episode and previous ones from our website. Simply visit parstoday.com and enter the Call of Islam tab where you will find Islamic upbringing. You can also email us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's englishradio@irib.ir. Until next episode, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dilawar of Yaqubi was born in Afghanistan's Khust province in 1979. Late in 2002, his family bought a used car for him to drive as a taxi. A few weeks later, on the eve of the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr, Dilawar's mother asked him to bring his three sisters from their nearby villages home for the holiday. However, he needed gas money and decided to drive to the provincial capital, Khust, to look for fares. On his way back, he found three men headed back towards Yaqubi at a taxi stand there. On the way, they passed a base used by American troops, Camp Salerno, which had been the target of a rocket attack that morning. The Toyota was stopped, and a broken walkie-talkie was confiscated from one of Dilawar's passengers. Then the four men were detained and had to spend their first night handcuffed to a fence so they would be unable to sleep. They were later sent to Bagram Collection Point, the headquarters for US forces in Afghanistan, and a key detention and interrogation center. According to Dilawar's fellow prisoners, for him, the most difficult thing seemed to be the black cloth hood that was pulled over his head. He could not breathe, they said. 5 days later, he was dead. The U.S. Army initially declared that Dilawar had died of natural causes, but a New York Times reporter named Carlotta Gall managed to track down Dilawar's family in Yaqubi and found out from his death certificate that he had died of homicide. Further investigation revealed that Dilawar died of a pulmonary embolism caused by trauma to his legs that were so severe that the coroner said his legs were pulpified and looked like they had been run over by a truck. As Dilawar moaned and cried out for his mother and father, the guards would pummel him with knee strikes over and over again, just to shut him up, or sometimes for their amusement, just to hear him scream, Allah.
But just that one night, he got kicked in the leg, maybe like 10 times.
Some of the soldiers said they started using the knee strikes essentially to shut him up because he was yelling and screaming.
The damage that was done from multiple strikes, and a lot of that could have been avoided had you known the person before you had fought with them and used that exact technique.
Sergeant Salcedo, who was an experienced interrogator but a kind of a can-do soldier, had this man who refused to look at her because she was a woman. She said she got very frustrated by this and grabbed him by the sides of the face and sort of turned him to face her and look at her and take her seriously. But of course, he was an Afghan man from a tribal conservative culture who didn't look at strange women.
Sergeant Salcedo was getting a little aggravated, so I kind of stepped in between them, and that's when I grabbed him by the shirt and I brought him over to the wall.
Finally, Dilawar died on December 10th, only 5 days after he was transferred to the Bagram collection point.
The ceiling of these isolation rooms was just a simple metal grate, and it was thick enough you could put handcuffs, you know, through the wires of that, and just kind of chain them up like that, out to the sides like this.
First, we're not chaining people to the ceiling. That's what he says.
The Bagram collection point is situated next to the Bagram airbase in the Parwan province of Afghanistan. The prison was built by the United States during the Bush administration. While initially intended as a temporary facility, it has been used longer and handled more detainees than the U.S. Guantanamo Bay detention camp in Cuba. It has also been compared to Abu Ghraib prison. Meanwhile, Captain Carolyn Wood, the officer in charge of interrogation at Bagram during Dilawar's incarceration, was later given a Bronze Star and sent to Abu Ghraib. Abu Ghraib prison was a prison complex in Abu Ghraib, Iraq, located 32 kilometers west of Baghdad. It was opened in the 1950s and served as a maximum security prison with torture, weekly executions, and squalid living conditions. From the 1980s, the prison was used by Saddam Hussein and later the United States to hold political prisoners. It developed a reputation for torture and extrajudicial killings and was closed in 2002. It was reopened by the US after the 2003 invasion. At 2 a.m. on November 4th, 2003, a man named Manadel Al-Jamadi was captured by Navy SEALs after a violent struggle at his house outside Baghdad. Jamadi savagely fought one of the SEALs before being subdued in his kitchen. Jamadi was considered by the CIA a suspect in an attack on the Al-Rashid Hotel during a visit by Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz in October 2003. After he was removed from his house, he was transferred to CIA custody for interrogation at Abu Ghraib. He was taken to a shower room for interrogation. Then, some 45 minutes later, he was dead. After Jamadi's death, his corpse was packed in ice. The corpse was in the background for widely reprinted photographs of grinning U.S. Army specialists Sabrina Harmon and Charles Grainer, each of whom offered a thumbs-up gesture. Associated Press correspondent Seth Hatena reported that 30 minutes after beginning his questioning of the prisoner, the CIA interrogator called for guards to reposition Al-Jamadi, who he believed was playing possum as he slouched with his arms stretched behind him. But the guards found otherwise. After we found out he was dead, they were nervous, specialist Dennis Stavanis said of the CIA interrogator and translator. They didn't know what the hell to do. Staff Sergeant Ivan Frederick wrote an account to his family in November 2003, that interrogators had stressed him out so bad that the man died. Prison personnel put his body in a body bag and packed him in ice for approximately 24 hours in the shower. The next day, the medics came and put his body on a stretcher, placed a fake IV in his arm, and took him away. No one has been charged with his death. In 2011, Attorney General Eric Holder said that he had opened a full criminal investigation into Al-Jamadi's death. In August 2012, Holder announced that no criminal charges would be brought. It should be noted that these are only two examples of what the American forces have done in the detention camps in Iraq and Afghanistan. Based on compelling evidence, it can be said with certainty that what happened at Abu Ghraib and Bagram were no aberrations, but part of a widespread pattern.
In her sworn testimony about Abu Ghraib, Captain Woods said she felt pressure to produce intelligence. So she brought unauthorized techniques, dogs, nudity, sleep deprivation, and stress positions, to Abu Ghraib from Afghanistan. Wood maintained that the Bagram model had tacit approval from superiors, but U.S. Central Command had never responded to her request for authorization. So the mystery remained. Was Abu Ghraib the work of a few bad apples, or evidence of a new worldwide system of detention and interrogation?
This debate is occurring because of the Supreme Court's ruling that said that we must conduct ourselves under the Common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention. And that Common Article 3 says that, you know, there will be no outrages upon human dignity. It's very vague. What does that mean?
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.